I'm Bert Cohen, and it's time for Portside.
Can you hear us? Okay. Yes, you are. Good. So, all right, let me take about a minute or so, and we'll be right to you. Thanks so much.
Are living in the USA where we, the people, have power over our own destiny. Do we not? Well, there are a lot of countries in the world where people, frankly, especially women, have less ability to participate in shaping their own future and shaping their own government. And that certainly has been a problem in Afghanistan. Welcome to another edition of Portside. I'm Bert Cohen. And with us today is Jody Evans out in California. Thanks for being with us.
Thank you.
And let me tell the people a little bit about who you are. Jody Evans has been a community, social, and political organizer for the last 35 years and has used her skills to give voice to communities and people who go unheard and unseen and to protect the rights of women. From 1973 to 82, she served in administrative capacity in all of Jerry Brown's campaigns and in his staff and cabinet as director of administration. Breakthroughs in wind and solar energy happened while she was overseeing the Office of Appropriate Technology. And she is co-founder of Code Pink, Women for Peace, and has spent the last 7 years working to end the occupations of Iraq and Afghanistan. She serves on many boards, including Rainforest Action Network, Women's Media Center, Sisterhood is Global Initiative, and Drug Policy Alliance. Well, again, thanks for being with us. And you had the president's ear, quite literally, at a recent Democratic fundraiser. You got a lot of FaceTime with President Barack Obama. A lot of us would like to have that chance. How did you get to speak to the president and have his ear for as long as you did?
I had just returned from Afghanistan, where I had gone to hear what the women wanted, given that it was the 8th anniversary of our invasion and occupation. So a friend of mine who goes to Democratic fundraising dinners had bought a ticket for dinner and said, I want to take you because I want Barack to hear what the women of Afghanistan sent you home with. And so I went as her date and actually had more time than I expected with him. And also he listened more than I expected.
Wow. Well, what was your intent? What were you? Tell us about your conversation. What did you talk about? And that's interesting that he listened more than you expected.
Well, I've had other occasions to over the last couple of years to talk to him about getting out of Iraq and that there's no such thing as a good war. And he usually comes back at me with a quip or something to set me up, set me down. And this time I was ready for that. But instead, he really was listening to what I had to say, which started out with, we have to bring the troops home from Afghanistan because no matter, you could send a million troops, if you don't do something about the corruption, it doesn't matter. The Afghans, you know, hate us every day that passes. And the election was a fraud. And then I handed him the signatures of women who said, you know, no more troops. When I had left to go, the McChrystal report had been leaked. So I asked everyone, do you want more troops? And so all these women had signed no, including members of parliament and NGOs and human rights workers. And after I handed it to him, and he then handed it to his staff, I said, women have to be at the negotiating table. And he said, well, who do you think my Secretary of State is? And you know, I have a woman ambassador. He couldn't remember her name. And I said, no. The women of Afghanistan need to be at the negotiating table. And he said, oh.
Uh-huh.
Like it was a new idea.
Yeah.
And then, you know, I kept talking, and he started patting my shoulder. I kept saying, you know, everything that I'd seen that was wrong, that we'd spent $250 billion, it was worse, that the women aren't free and secure now. We haven't done that over 8 years. What made him think that we were going to be able to accomplish that? That we can't fix it. And the more we stay, the more they hate us. And then he patted me on my shoulder and said, I'm not going to be able to fix Afghanistan quickly. And I said, you're not going to be able to fix Afghanistan at all. Only they will. And with that, I was pushed away.
Well, that's quite a bit of time. I know that in the past, when I got a chance to talk to then-President Clinton, you were allowed a certain amount of seconds, and that was it, and then move along. They're pretty careful about that. Well, that's great that you got to do that. And, you know, I hear that perhaps things may have gotten better for women in Afghanistan since the invasion of fall of 2001. But then again, you know, things were pretty bad before we got there. Women now have some position in government. They have have seats in the parliament. 17% of the seats in the upper house are women. 27% in the lower house are women. 85 women in all. Is that not progress, or is there more to the story than that in terms of where the real power still lies?
Well, yeah, there's always more to the story.
I figured.
I don't want to belittle what it means to have 25% of the elected officials be women. But women want to make sure that you know that they're not safer, they're not freer, and that they still live in a prison, and that when there is, you know, the level of violence and corruption in the street, that there isn't freedom. So, yes, some things have changed, but the you know, the wolf is still at the door.
Well, I wonder about women's role. Certainly, there's a long tradition in Afghanistan, and I, having never been there, having friends who have been there, they talk about the traditional versus liberated, and there, you know, there are women who wear the burqas and want to, I guess, continue to do that. And I wonder, you know, what, and there are, you know, I don't think you can say what the women of Afghanistan want. I'm sure that there are divisions among women, or I would think so. And I wonder if it's not cultural imperialism to push our values of what you and I would call liberation into their culture, or is there a real longing for that? They must have.
Well, I don't think the burqa is an issue. It's, you know, it's our usual concern in the Middle East about women's heads being covered. That's not an issue for them, as it's not an issue for women in, you know, Iran or,
mm-hmm.
you know, that's not what an issue is for them. Issue for them is security. That's the huge issue for them. Women, oh, you know, a lot of the women that I met there that still wear the burqa wear it for protection from the warlords that are, you know, still going around and, you know, raping at you know, their leisure, anyone that they find attractive.
Yikes.
So a lot of the young women wear the burqa to just hide themselves. That's their form of security.
And to be free from that oppression.
Pardon?
And to be free from that oppression, I suppose.
So, you know, we've created a kind of a criminal state, as we have in Iraq, where we go in and we buy the people with guns and power, and we buy them more guns and more power, and then there's just total destabilization. It's like living in South Central Los Angeles, where, you know, it's a gang war going on around you. You never get to really breathe or let go. It lowers kids' IQs. it doesn't really create life. It's and so, you know, you were talking about us delivering our values. I mean, we're trying to deliver democracy to a place that has had a way of governing themselves for some 6,000 years.
Mm-hmm.
And on top of that, we're trying to deliver something that even we don't have perfectly. And in the process, because of our own, not acknowledging what we have, literally I feel like I witnessed the road to hell is paved with good intentions writ large.
Mm.
We make so many mistakes from our own ignorance, and they pay for that, including what just happened around the elections. Kerry goes there and he talks Karzai into having another election that everyone knew was a fraud. Did anybody ask the people of Afghanistan if they wanted another election?
Mm.
They didn't want to go through that again. They didn't want that level of insecurity. So what happens is that yet again, we're the stupid Westerners that are going to subject them to more death and destruction. And so Abdullah, who's a war criminal, becomes the hero of the Afghan people yet again, because he's the one smart enough to say, to call us, you know, to tell the truth, which is it's impossible to have fair elections when you have the same corrupt electing board that you can't change in such a short period of time. I mean, we just look clueless and stupid and that we don't care at all for the people of Afghanistan. And as we stay there, we continue to inspire their hatred by killing them, by leveling their villages, and by acting stupidly. We have spent $250 billion wow, on Afghanistan, and the place is worse than when we got there. The Taliban is control of 80% of the country, and Kabul, which is the rest of the country, isn't safe.
We are talking with Jody Evans, co-founder of Code Pink, who has traveled to Afghanistan. And I've spoken a couple times with Ann Jones, who's written a wonderful book called Kabul in Winter. Mm-hmm. She told me that when the U.S. overthrew the Taliban, that people were thrilled, and that a lot of Afghanis figured, okay, they're free from the Taliban, who clearly were pretty repressive. And what they expected was help from Americans, where they really needed education, medicine, agriculture, engineers, transportation. And then we didn't do it. It became all military. Was that your experience as well?
Yeah, I mean, definitely the Afghans, you know, it was a bit like when we elected Obama, you know, everybody felt hopeful and you know, things were going to change and the possibility of a new world was right there.
Yeah.
And instead, Bush just took everything and invaded an innocent country.
Yeah.
And left Afghanistan to warlords they put in power. And again, it just devolved, and slowly the Taliban came back into power because they delivered, they promised the same thing they promised the first time around. The reason the Taliban came into power the first time around was that there was this horrific civil war that these warlords were waging against each other. And so the Taliban comes in and it promises justice and peace, which it's able to deliver in a bizarre way.
Mm-hmm.
One of the things that we haven't been able to deliver is justice. And the Taliban has been able to do that by creating some kind of adjudication, you know, some kind of court system where people at least can get judgment around things, where, you know, with their guns, they're able to create security. Now, it's not a security for the women. But even the women say, at least when the Taliban's in power, you know that if you just stay at home, you're safe. They're not going to come rape you and kill you. But with the warlords, it's just this kind of free-for-all. And that's so now between putting the warlords in power and Karzai having to give them power so that he can keep his power. And the vacuum of power that's created by our presence, the Taliban is back, delivering, you know, getting power the same way they did before, by delivering security and justice.
Security is an important thing, for sure, and certainly people do want justice. And if we create or help create anarchy and chaos, people want security, and the Taliban are indigenous. So I don't know how we could possibly win. Well, tell us...
I met with a woman who's a member of parliament from Wardak. It's a province outside of Kabul.
Okay.
And it's where it's, you know, where our soldiers are because there's the Taliban. And one time she came home and a man and his son had just been killed next door. And she said to the U.S., you know, why did you kill him? It was a, you know, she's a OBGYN. She'd given birth to, the, you know, all the kids and the family. And and they said because he was talking to a Taliban. And she screams, you know, Tali, they're us. What are you talking about? I go to their funerals and their weddings and their, you can't kill people for talking to Talis. They're their family. And so that's, you know, we indoctrinate stupidly our military so that they are constantly creating a situation where we're hated, not from, just from not knowing, you know, not from bad will, but just by being dumb.
I can't help but think that, you know, I've talked to occasional supporters of the U.S. Occupation of Iraq and Afghanistan, and I, you know, say to them, how would you feel if some military that came in and occupied our country and was completely unfamiliar with our culture? Well, of course. And I must say, I saw the there was a recent NPR or PBS rather broadcast, and it showed American soldiers trying to make friends with the village male elders. And I was expecting to be impressed at how, you know, ineffective it was. I was shocked. I was absolutely shocked. They go up to these, you know, elder men and say, oh, we're your friends. We're your friends. Then they walk away. That's not going to cut it. It's really amazing to me. Well, Jody, tell us about when did you go to Afghanistan? What group was it with? And tell us about what that trip was.
I went right after the McChrystal report came out and arrived back a few days before the 8th anniversary. So it was the end of September, beginning of October.
Mm-hmm.
And I organized the trip because I wanted to, on the anniversary, be able to speak about what the women wanted, because they continue to be used as the reason we're there from day one. You know, we're there to free the women. But the women don't feel like, well, the women say they have not been freed. I didn't meet a woman that would agree with that. And also I wanted to bring their voices back to talk about, you know, sending more soldiers. So I met with everyone from the people who work in the streets, people who run really effective NGOs that work with women, people who run schools, to warlords and the ministers in the Karzai government and Taliban ministers from, you know, the time when the Taliban was in power. So it was a very diverse swath. And, you know, just as in the United States, there's as many opinions as there are people.
Yeah.
So I don't feel like I, you know the right answer. I just have a sense of where some threads cross and, you know, where everyone says the same thing. And I have to say, when I was there, I got very depressed. It's a horrific situation that we have created, a horrific situation, and that we've participated in creating over 30 years now.
30 years now?
Yeah.
Could you explain that a little bit?
Well, I mean, we started engaging in destabilizing Afghanistan 30 years ago. And, you know, sending troops to go after the Russians. And we've been behind the scenes creating havoc for a very long time, and they know it. They know their history better than we know their history.
What a surprise, really. Yeah, I believe a lot of American Republican money people were funneling aid to the Taliban to overthrow the Soviet occupiers. And so we, as I understand it, I have not been to Afghanistan, we helped to create the Taliban.
Right, and we also armed and funded the warlords. So,
yeah.
The whole military is the solution.
Mm-hmm.
Problem in Afghanistan is a monster that we planted.
Wow.
And that we've continued to fuel. So we're we've funded the thing that we're fighting against and created it, taught it, you know, everything. And they know that, and they hate us for it. And that military continues to be the answer is another thing they hate us for. We continue, McChrystal, his whole idea yet again is to train more Afghan military, I think he said 400,000. I met with the guy who's the economist for Afghanistan. Now, he's really the brother-in-law of Karzai.
Oh, right.
So he doesn't know, but I had him, it's not somebody like economist that we have here, but not that I'm so thrilled with ours, but... he said that they're already $3 billion in debt, and they have nowhere. How would they pay for these 400,000 soldiers? And the training of the soldiers there, I talked to the head of the police department in Kabul. He said the training that we're giving is so horrific that when they send these trainees out in the field, everybody takes their guns away from them because they're basically they're more dangerous than the enemy. And that there's a 50% desertion rate. So we train the military, then we arm them, and they're not really trained. It's horrific because we're just trying to cut corners. They said that, as in Vietnam, we would count the dead, as whether we were succeeding
mm-hmm.
or not. Now we count how many people, how many soldiers we've trained. And so we cut corners just to train them, so we just want a number. And so they really don't get trained, and then we don't pay them well, so they desert and join the Taliban. So we're training the Taliban, basically. Not only are we training them, but then, we've budgeted $1.5 billion that goes through USAID for building bridges and
uh-huh.
hospitals. So here's what happened. The only way that you can get a contract from USAID is if you have these certain accounting capacities, because of course you need to be accountable. It's the U.S. money, right? So there needs to be some accountability.
Hmm.
But to create that accountability, the only people who can get the money aren't people who can actually do the job. They just know how to get the money. So they get the money, and then they contract. Then they have to go find somebody who can actually do the job. So they go and they find somebody in Kabul who can go find somebody in the province who can actually do the job. And then that person takes half the money. So, you're down to a quarter of the money. Then they go to the province and they find somebody who can find somebody, and then they take half the money. By the time they find somebody who can actually do the job, there's not enough money left to do the job. So they give the rest of the money to the Taliban for protection.
Great policy. My goodness. Bert Cohen here on Portside. We're talking with Jody Evans, co-founder of Code Pink, about realities on the ground in Afghanistan and women there. And I had heard that it's not that the U.S. is spending too much on aid. I mean, too little on aid. We're spending too much, actually, because as Ann Jones has said, most of the aid is not actually delivered by the U.S. Agency for International Development, which has some degree of competence. But as you described the process, it goes down man to man and warlord to warlord, corruption, provincial reconstruction teams. It sounds like a tremendous amount of money that's available, and where corruption reigns, it's not going to really help the people. And
Oh, oh yeah, and the generals now have cash they get to hand out, which is just destructive. They try to do that here, you know, in South Central, you know, with the gang members. Like, the wild thing is that whenever you manipulate somebody, they're the ones that can manipulate you more. Like, you learn that, you know, early in life, usually.
Uh-huh.
But,
And you talked about the subject of Vietnam was bound to come up. I mean, I am certainly old enough to remember Vietnamization, where, you know, it was a scheme to, it was all about saving face and, no, we'll pull our troops out and then we'll train the Vietnamese. And of course, you know, the NLF fighters, the nationalists in Vietnam, the so-called Viet Cong, they knew exactly what they were fighting for. They knew every square inch of land there. They knew all the people, whereas the Americans certainly were invaders and didn't know exactly what we were fighting for. And one doesn't want to try to draw too many analogies, but my goodness, it sounds so familiar. The waste, corruption, greed, ineptitude, ending violence with violence. It sounds so much like the so-called government of Southern Vietnam, which was incredibly corrupt, had no real support, had just a bunch of warlords supporting it there. And guess what? You know, you could read the tea leaves back in the late 60s that we weren't going to prevail. You know, there was no real, the hearts and minds of the people were not with the government that we had imposed. How similar is it? Is it the same damn thing again?
Well, I think it's the same in that occupation is the same in that arrogant imperialism behaves in the same way, where you go in with this arrogant view that you're going to make everything better when you can only make everything worse because you actually don't understand where you are, are clueless, and the whole thinking process is off. It's impossible. I mean, that's the hard part, I think, you know, right now with Americans around Afghanistan. And I have to say, I felt it while I was there, so I have total sympathy for it. You're looking at a mess. I mean, it's, as the Afghans say, we're between a rock and a tiger's claw. And the problem is that we see things, we let our fears make our decisions for us, and we think with a Western mind. So we look at it and we think, okay, you know, we've messed it up. We have to fix it. But we can't fix it. So we keep throwing money and lives and stupidity at it. I think, you know, which is the same as what was happening in Vietnam. I think that's what you're saying, is that, yeah, we continue to behave in this way, and we can only make it worse. Yeah. That's why I said it's the road to hell paved with good intentions writ large. You know, somewhere in there is a good, I mean, I don't really think it's a good intention when you go in and think you're going to make something better in somebody's world. I think that's stupid. But somebody thinks it's a good intention. And so you can't help but be a disaster. Just like in Vietnam, just like in, I mean, look what we've done to poor Iraq. Yeah. I mean, I was in Iraq before we invaded. What we have done to that country is shameful. I mean, I came home, you know, yet again committed to put, you know, Bush in jail. Because there's corruption there, but it's created by the corruption here. You can't fix something that you haven't fixed in your own country. You can't export the solution if you have the problem.
Interesting. I was thinking back to some of the British imperialist legacy where probably a lot of citizens of formerly Great Britain thought that, well, we're bringing a better civilization to these poor, you know, less than people, you know.
Right. You know, that they're so ungrateful, you know.
Yeah, I can imagine.
Yeah. I mean, you heard that around Iraq. I mean, at least I did, where people would say, look, we've brought them freedom, and they're so ungrateful, and you can't believe that's come out of someone's mouth.
I know, it's amazing how...
But the propaganda, you know, is pretty thick.
Well, what is your sense, Jody Evans, of the process that President Obama is now going through about Afghanistan and Pakistan. You know, Lyndon Johnson could say he had no precedent, so he made a heck of a lot of mistakes. He was basically, I think, a well-intentioned president in terms of domestic policy and did a lot of good domestically, but the war in Vietnam ruined him, and there was no, he didn't know what to do. And a lot of Americans, as well as Vietnamese, lost lives, lost limbs, saving face for LBJ. As he said, he didn't want to be the first president to lose a war. How important do you think domestic politics are in this new president, somebody in whom we've given a great deal of hope? How much of a role do you think domestic politics will play in his decision making? And give us a sense of your take on the process he's now going through.
You know, the problem is the people at the table. I mean, he's trying to be deliberate, but he's got the same people at the table. So I don't know how it works that you take your time to make a decision, but I mean, the fact that he was shocked that I said, you know, Afghan women need to be at the table, he doesn't have Afghans at the table. You know, men or women, he's making this decision. I said, you need to bring people from Afghanistan, people who are Afghans, not people who are in power. It's the same problem we run into, you know, when we're trying to solve a problem in the U.S. And everybody's, it's talking heads instead of people who really know how to deal with the situation. So, you know, I appreciate that he's deliberating, but I don't see anybody at the table that's going to help him make a better decision. I see the same people at the table that were there for, you know, LBJ. It's the people that, you know, are bought and sold by war. I mean, war is a big business, and all these people who do this are, that's their job. Are they going to say that military isn't the solution? Even the Pentagon says military isn't the solution.
Right, right.
They say that to find security, you have to invest 80% in development. We're not, they said that out of their mouths. That was out of their mouths.
Mm-hmm.
And at the same time, Congress just voted $100 more billion for war, and in it was $100 million for development for women. I mean, it's insane. They behave like addicts. You know, it's like they know what's healthy and right, but they can't do it. It's you know, this is the drug, and it's crazy.
Wow, that really is crazy. I don't really know. It's an interesting point you bring up. Who is at the table that Obama is meeting with? And
well, I mean, let's just look at what, okay, the same people that have been in the State Department for a very long time. Brzezinski? I mean, hello?
Zbigniew Brzezinski?
Wow, yeah.
I didn't know that.
Yeah. I mean, they're talking to the same people that have failed over and over again.
So these largely white, powerful men are going to make decisions about the future of Afghanistan, and really there aren't people from Afghanistan involved in that? That's absolutely
people
shocking
from
to
Afghanistan
me.
That are involved, like Karzai, the ambassador.
I don't know the name, but so it's people who have some power in
Afghanistan.
These
are Westerners. These are people who left Afghanistan in the 70s that have come back, and because they're Western, they get the power, but they don't represent the people.
Hmm.
It's the same thing that happened in Iraq,
sure,
where we gave the power to people that weren't actually the people who had lived there.
Right.
That, you know, we do this over and over again.
But Obama seems...
Why? Because, and why do we do it? It's because there's the people we can talk to. We trust them, but the reason we trust them is the same reason they're clueless, is because they're us, not them.
Us and not them. Well, you, I believe, supported Obama for president. How disappointed may you be? Or is there some degree of hope that he will do things differently? He's a very bright man who can certainly understand that imperialism, guess what? It never, ever works. You know, the people want to govern themselves.
Okay, well, I'm not that disappointed because I wasn't expecting that much. I mean, he's a politician.
Yeah.
He's going to behave like a politician. He's going to be, you know, inside Washington, and it's corrupting. It's corrupting. It is its own monster, you know. So, I just wanted the United States of America to elect a black president. For me, that was the victory. Anything after that, you know, it's politics. And the interesting thing that the next morning after I gave him the letters from the women, I got to go to a briefing by his deputy chief of staff. And what I learned from this deputy chief of staff, which isn't what he told me, but what I heard between the lines is that basically Congress is in power.
Oh.
That Obama is fully listening to Congress. And it made sense because who did he make his chief of staff? It was Congress and the people around him making the decisions and giving him input are from Congress.
Hmm.
And he came out of the Senate.
And they're all about oftentimes.
And they're all, and who do they represent? Corporate interests.
Yeah, largely. And keeping power.
Which is, you know, and how they do that is by raising money. And so who's in power? The corporate interests that keep them in their jobs.
Yeah. Wow. We are talking on Portside. I'm Bert Cohen. We're talking with Jody Evans, co-founder of Code Pink, about women in Afghanistan. And I had spoken to one of my favorite politicians, George McGovern, who had suggested, hey, the way to deal with Afghanistan is to help women, young girls in particular, get educated. That's absolutely the key. That's what he was saying. What's your reaction to that? How important?
I totally agree. I mean, that's what, you know, I come back with is, you know, we have to be fighting as hard as we can. And I've been talking to Barbara Boxer about this, get women what they need. And we know this around the world, that when we fund young girls, the country, the village, whatever, you know, what you want to call it, wherever it is, improves. And that's true in Afghanistan.
Hmm. And I understand this is an interesting snapshot that the mayor of Kabul, oh, I guess he's president, Karzai, his wife, who is a doctor with much needed skills, is in fact kept locked up at her home.
I don't know, locked up, but yeah, she doesn't.
Well,
and he has to do that to please the, you know, the religious extremists.
Well, how much of? I mean, it's not. I don't really know, but I get the impression that it's not really. A nation particularly, it's not really a unified country. Okay, there's Kabul, but then there's this huge amount of territory that's, you know, very difficult to get from one place to another, and the warlords are in charge of their areas. And I don't know how much, if anything, that changed after our invasion. Did it?
I think it could. I mean, it might have changed in that the warlords are stronger than they've ever been. Finance than they've ever been. They never had money like what we're giving them. They never had this level of abundance, and they don't know what to do with it, which is another, you know, crime that we've committed. We in every way, we make the life of an Afghan worse. And one of those ways is the funding of the warlords. I met a warlord who we gave $25 million to.
Whoa.
To take the U.S. military to Tora Bora, and then we gave it to three warlords. One of the warlords, who I believe is now dead, let Osama know before they arrived. So he took the $25 million and tipped off Osama. I mean, so this is like how dumb we are. You know, so then the other two warlords take the military to Tora Bora, but Osama's already gone. So that's $75 million. Well, this one warlord, he had to be exiled because the other warlords were mad at him that he took the money and they all, you know, that he kind of undermined them. So he's been living in France all this time. And he got pulled back by Karzai to deliver his tribe to Karzai for the elections. And so he's held up in a hotel in Kabul under the protection of Karzai because he would be killed, you know, if he went out in the streets. But he you know, just he talks about how dumb we are. But the other thing is that he's become, I don't know how to say it. It's like he despises his country now because it's become kind of fat and silly and corrupt. And he looks at the corrupting influence of the U.S. and sees his country gone. Like, what had value, like who Afghans were, he can't even find that anymore. I mean, he was, you know, kind of repulsed by what had happened. And that, you know, he said, you know, Afghans had just become kind of fat and lazy, which was, you know, it's like when you're in the, you know, when the frog is in the pan and it's boiling, you don't see it. Well, he came back and he could see it quite plainly because he hadn't been, you know, in the pot.
Right, right. And the water got slowly hotter and hotter. How, what are there brave women who are standing up and what are they doing?
Oh my God, every woman there is brave. I mean, because, you know, imagine they know that they come out of their house and they could be killed any minute. So just to walk out of their house is a courage. The women in parliament, you know, so earlier I said, you know, it's great that there's these women in parliament. They're also not respected at all. So they're there, but nobody respects them. Nobody takes them seriously. The men are still in charge. And an example of that is the rape law that, you know, with all these women in Congress and with Karzai promising them, he still signed this rape law. It's just horrendous. The rape law is worse than the laws that were under the Taliban, by the way. So the women agree, everyone that I asked, that this was a law worse than what existed under the Taliban.
And what is this rape law?
It's basically a law that says every woman has to do whatever their husband asks them.
Wow.
And submit to sex no matter, you know, when their husband asks.
That's the law? Oh, my.
And the law, and so, I mean, I met these amazing women who organized against this law and did an action. Now, there are women who'd never, you know, you have to remember, this isn't like actions for me and you. We understand that. We've lived in that world. They had never lived in that experience. It never had happened before. But they organized. They educated each other. They went, like, they said they went to, you know, a printing press, buildings where they could go and meet where it wouldn't be assumed that anything was happening there.
Yeah,
and
wow.
It was all, you know, very clandestine. And but this was so serious for them that they were willing to risk their lives. And so the day that they did the action, they went to a mosque, the mosque where the guy who actually controls the Shia law, it was his mosque. And they, you know, they did an action with signs and a messaging. And out of the mosque came 1,000 men and women with stones that they were throwing at these, like, 100 women.
Wow.
And if it wouldn't have been for the presence of the international media and the Kabul police, they would be dead. I mean, it was, you know, chance.
Absolutely
amazing.
But
they were just fierce in their belief that this couldn't happen and that they had to stand up for it and that their lives were meaningless if they didn't. I mean, we don't live like, I mean, it's hard for us as Americans to even understand that. You know, we protest kind of confidently that there will be laws to protect us.
Mm-hmm.
It doesn't mean we won't end up in jail, but there'll be some law in, you know, present to protect us.
And that there is a legal system here, yeah.
And there's a legal system. They don't have that. I mean, there is no legal system there. Warlords, you know, who are the ministers, they go out and their kids and them rape everyone, you know, kind of a little like Saddam. Iraq, and they don't go to jail. They're let out of jail. Even when, like, the local police arrest them for the rape, they're out of jail the next day.
Mm. I wonder how important is women's full participation in Afghani politics and society to achieve real peace and stability for the region as a whole? How important is women's real participation in there? And is what kind of chances are there? Is it just going to take a really long time?
You know, I don't know. I don't know. I mean, I looked at it and I thought it would take a generation to really, you know, create lasting change. Maybe it's, you know, 10 years. I don't know. Because I was in Kabul. I don't know what it looks like in the outskirts.
Uh-huh. Uh-huh.
You know, I met with some men that are, you know, work for a Western NGO. And, you know, I talked to them about, you know, their wives and everything. And, you know, they work for Western NGO. They work for a woman, you know, and a man. But they still believe that they want to have arranged marriages, that, you know, that works better. And they still want their wives to stay home and not work. You know,
so it's going to take a while.
I think about genital mutilation in Africa, and I've been working on that now for over 25 years, and it's just changing. So, you know, you have to change a whole culture. And, you know, now the fathers are coming and thanking the, you know, the workers in Africa for what they're doing, but it took a long time for that to happen.
Uh-huh.
It took, you know, women's lives being at risk. It took courage. It, you know, it took a lot, and it took a lot of support from the West. I mean, we need to start somewhere, and you know what it takes? It takes them doing it.
Right.
You have to support it, but then they have to do it, the women and men of their own community. And you have to turn a few hearts and minds, and then they have to turn the rest. And we can't do that. It's
right.
Like we can't fix it. They have to. You can't deliver democracy. It has to arise. And you have to trust. It's almost like, it's so funny. It's that we don't trust the process that we try to deliver. We don't trust people, which is what democracy is.
Wow, it is. People governing themselves.
Right.
We can't impose it.
It can't be done by control. It's the thing we're trying to deliver, but we're clueless about what it actually is.
Wow. We are.
Which is the people. I mean, democracy is about the people.
Yes.
But since we don't live inside of that, since we live inside right now a horrific, our, you know, democracy has been so undermined
by
money and politics.
Oh.
That we still live out of these notions that you can control it.
Mm-hmm.
We don't allow it to be messy.
You can't deliver it from above.
Pardon?
You can't deliver democracy from above. It can't be imposed
no.
at the barrel of a gun.
Or with weapons.
Yeah, exactly. Well, just a few more questions here. And I've heard it said that, well, if the U.S. just withdraws from Afghanistan, then we'd be abandoning women and girls. What's your reaction?
Well, withdraws militarily. We don't want to. We shouldn't withdraw our hearts and our concerns. I mean, we need to do what we haven't been doing. We need to be delivering real aid to Afghanistan. You know, like I said, the money that $250 billion has been spent, less than 10% has actually gotten to Afghanistan. We have to look at what we've been doing. You know, there needs to be, you know, a Marshall Plan or,
yes.
you know, something something that delivers our responsibility. But it's not through weapons.
Right.
It's not through war. It's not through violence.
Well, again, my old friend George McGovern used to say back a long, long time ago, he'd say, we can do more to dry up the swamplands of despair that breed, he then say communism, but now we could say terrorism. We could do more to dry up those that despair with our medical help, agricultural help, technical help, than with all the military hardware in our vast arsenal.
Well, let's just look at what creates terrorism is poverty
right.
and disrespect and abuse of power. So we have to quit it.
Yeah.
It's like we continue to create. We are fueling the fire that we say we're trying to end. And so we have to go in. I mean, we have created more poverty by our presence. We, you know, we go in with this money and we destabilize the whole system because now in Kabul, an Afghan can't afford to live because we've driven the prices up so much. There's this occupation society that erupts, you know, in the middle of, you know, the poverty, which, you know, all these NGOs with lots of money, and they come in and they take up all the space. And so it becomes not Afghanistan. It becomes this strange construction of a world that has nothing to do with Afghanistan.
Wow. Well, Jody Evans, if you were the decider and had a few billion dollars at your disposal, what would you do in Afghanistan?
I would take those few billion dollars, which I just want to say it's a few billion dollars compared to the quarter of a trillion we've spent.
Right.
With a few billion dollars invested in the grassroots problem solvers that are working, that, you know, have been able to create solutions, that have gone into communities and talked to the religious leaders and showed them that, you know, what they call, you know, Islamic law isn't Islamic law, and that, you know, in Islam, women are supposed to be respected and honored, and this isn't happening, and that, you know, come in and change the way the laws have been taught, and come, you know, create more schools, bring doctors from around the world. Yeah, we need to bring troops of doctors and business leaders and give the money to the Afghans. They are the only ones that know how to solve their problems. And give it to them in small amounts with recognizable goals. They're, you know, one of the Afghans that I met has, you know, fantastic ideas about how you instill a community's engagement in fixing their own community. We don't do that. We just come in, dump something on top of them, something they don't want and they don't value, and it's gone the next day because it's been destroyed or vandalized. Or that you go into the community, you figure out what they want to do, you invest in that, the community figures it out together, each one takes a piece of it, and together they have to make it work. And then they won't have time to fight each other or kill each other, because really all they want, like all anybody wants, is peace and to be able to raise their families and live a peaceful life.
What a
That's
concept.
What they want, like every other person on the planet.
Right. What would be a role that you would suggest for women in America? I know there's Congressman Jim McGovern has a resolution calling on the Pentagon to develop an exit strategy. What would you urge your colleagues here in America to do?
Yes, to support Jim McGovern's exit strategy and Barbara Lee's No More Troops bill. I mean, to call on both of those.
All right, and I'm sure there's an appropriate website that you would suggest.
So you can go to codepinkalert.org, codepinkalert.org, and we give you something to, you can sign up for our alerts. We give you something to do every week.
Mm-hmm.
We go out into the field or, you know, to Afghanistan. We come back with what is the most effective thing you can be doing that week for peace.
Ah, codepinkalert.org.
Right.
Thank you.
And this week, that is around Gaza. There is a Goldstone report.
Oh, yes.
Members of Congress are going to vote to deny the Goldstone report. It is a denial of justice that is shameful, that it's happening in the halls of Congress on a busy day, you know, hidden away. It is disgusting what they are doing. And so if you want to pick up the phone right now and call your member of Congress and tell them that they cannot vote, I'm sure they, you know, ask them if they've read and then tell them they cannot vote against the Goldstone report or they will be denying justice.
Jody Evans of Code Pink, thank you so much for spending time with us today. And I'm sure we'll be following you years to come. Thanks so much.
Thank you so much.
Bert Cohen here. You've been listening to Portside.
We struck up a conversation there in Grand Central Station, just two women waiting for a train. She was in her 60s, just ahead of my mid-50s. I was from the West, she from Maine. I'd been looking at the picture of the peace march in the paper. Wished I had risen to my feet from my despair. When she leaned across and pointed to things that you said to me. You know what? I was there. We the people stand in the hard rain pouring down. We'll not be prisoners of war. We will not cast the stone. We the people stand in peace persuaded. We'll harvest not the dragon's teeth. No, no, not the dragon's teeth. No, not the dragon's teeth that they have sown. Oh, were you there? I wish I had been. I'm just not a brave, bold person. I've never marched or spoken up, to say the least. Now terror falls upon the land. I'm so afraid to take a stand. How do you know if you are brave enough for peace? She turned to me and said, oh miss, I haven't always been like this. I used to be real quiet, just like you. But since the 9/11, I've been thinking less of heaven and more about this little planet spinning blue. Stand in the hard rain pouring down. We'll not be prisoners of war. We will not cast the stone. We the people stand in peace persuaded. We'll harvest not the dragon's teeth. No, no, not the dragon's teeth. No, not the dragon's teeth that they have sown. I lost my child, my boy, my son. I lost my mind, I watched it break in two. I sailed around the world in grief, full of rage, with no relief, until the homeboy started sewing dragon's teeth. I sailed around the world in grief, full of rage, with no relief, homeboys started sewing dragon's teeth. It was then I had the notion to lead a peace march on the ocean. 200 round the ship, we marched in peace. And something happened to me out there. I felt such peace come out of nowhere as we sang the news that we shall live in peace.